The Iowa Sex Offender Registry includes people within a wide range of offenses, and some lobbyists here at the Capitol are asking the question, should all sex offenders be put under the same restrictions? This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Sex offenders in Iowa are living out lifetime parole sentences that restrict where they live, work, and have limited interaction with family and friends. A bill that has sailed through both the Senate and the House would allow sex offenders to have lifetime parole sentences lifted under specific circumstances. We'll talk with lobbyists for the bill, one who is undecided, and a sex offender and former lobbyist for the bill. Join our conversation after this news. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. A bill that has sailed through both the Iowa Senate and the House would allow sex offenders to have lifetime parole sentences lifted under specific circumstances, including so-called Romeo and Juliet cases. My guest today to talk about the bill, one is Michael Byers, a sex offender and former lobbyist for the bill. He joins us in our Iowa City studios. Michael, thanks for being on the show today.
And thank you for having me, Clay.
On the phone is Karen Hamilton, a public service executive at the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Karen, thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
And here in the Statehouse Law Library is Nicole Merrill, a staff attorney at the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The organization's lobbyists were originally against the bill, but after further consideration are now undecided. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And Randall Wilson, legal director at the Iowa American Civil Liberties Union. He works with sex offenders on their constitutional rights. Randall, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And we reached out to lawmakers, both Republicans and Democrats, and they either declined or were unavailable to come onto the show. River to River listeners, what's your take on this bill? Do you know a sex offender? Should sex offenders' parole sentencing be lifted in certain circumstances? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. We're on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio or tweet us at IPR Talk. I'm on there, too, at Clayton Masters. Michael, I want to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your story and why you've been so committed to this bill?
Yeah, I can. I have been so committed to the bill because it has restricted my availability to raise my own child. In 2007, I was finishing up my high school term. I was a high school senior. I had a consensual relationship with a high school freshman. She was 13. She was a month and a half away from being 14, and I had just turned 18. The lascivious acts with a minor charge that I was charged with, I was charged with that because of the four-year age difference. So it was 23 days that actually got me charged of the crime. It was not a crime of force. It was strictly due to our age difference. That has put me on lifetime parole. It sent me to prison 3 days after I graduated high school and required me to register as a sex offender for the first time in my principal's office.
So this is what is commonly referred to as a Romeo and Juliet case. Is that right?
Yeah. We have a lot of cases in Iowa where certain teenagers are staying inside of their social set and parents are intervening into the relationship. And then the sex offender or perpetrator is charged with a sexual abuse crime, even if the offense was consensual.
And now you said that you have a son as well.
Yes, he's four.
And so this is limiting the time that you can spend with your son.
It actually eliminated the time that I can spend with my son. Under the lifetime parole sentence, one of the requirements is you are not allowed to have contact with minors. There are some applications that you can apply to be around certain minors in certain circumstances. But in my case, the mother of my child, who was my high school sweetheart, she was a grade below me, was against me having contact with my son due to the sole purpose that she did not want him to be ostracized by members in in society. She did not want him to be made fun of because his dad is a sex offender. And in most cases, if the mother is against the offender having contact with the child, the Board of Parole denies that request, even if you have a court order. I do have a court order now that states that I have visitation with my son every Saturday for 6 hours each Saturday, and the Board of Parole has overruled that.
I want to bring Karen Hamilton into the discussion here with the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Karen, can you tell us a little bit about the current laws, regulations, and why these are in place?
The registry was mandated by federal code, and the only restrictions that we have in place at this time have to do with exclusion zones, residence restriction, and prohibited employment.
So what would change in this bill?
None of that is actually addressed in the bill, as far as I know.
So let's talk a little bit about what the bill would do then. Karen, what do you bring into that?
From my knowledge of the bill, it would potentially allow a sex offender to be removed from the registry. If that's the case, then the registration requirements of 692A, the registry, would no longer apply.
So, Michael, in your case, go ahead, Karen.
No, I mean, as far as specific subsets of the registry, as far as I know, that bill does not address any of those.
So, Michael, how would this change things for you then?
I'd like to explain what Senate File 385 does. Senate File 385 is an act modifying the imposition of certain special sentences, and I would like to add some emphasis on the word certain. To qualify for this early discharge from lifetime parole and lifetime registry, there are certain requirements that one would have to meet. One would be that the perpetrator was not over the age of 18 at the time of the conviction, so anyone under the age of 18 at the time of the conviction would qualify. The victim of the offense requiring the special sentence was 13 years of age or older. What we were trying to do there was cover a high school age bracket to cover those Romeo and Juliet type cases. And another important part of the bill is, in order to qualify, the offense requiring the special sentence did not involve force or a threat of force and was not done against the will of the victim. So there is an age bracket to qualify for the early discharge, and it also had to be consensual. There's also other factors that apply, such as a risk assessment. The state of Iowa uses Static 99 to assess each individual sex offender in the state of Iowa, and the sex offender would have to be classified as a low risk to reoffend also to qualify for this bill. So there's a lot of protection in this bill. This bill does not open a door for child molesters to be removed from the registry or from parole. It allows people who have been trapped in a very wide net that was cast in 2005 to apply to the district court, so the district court can hear all evidence in the case and deem it necessary or unnecessary to continue the lifetime parole and sex offender registry sentences.
So, Karen, what are the different tiers of sex offenders on the registry?
There are Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3, and that tiering is based on the statute the person was convicted under.
So an example would be, for a Tier 1 would be, what would that offense be?
There are a number of offenses. The type of offense that is a Tier 1, you have harassment, you have like receipt or possession of child pornography. You have some of the sex abuse charges for when the person is under 14. So there are about 16 different possible codes that would be a Tier 1.
So I'd like to bring Randall into the conversation with the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. How do you come at this bill? What are the things that are important to you?
Well, what's important to us are sentences and punishments that are proportionate to the crime and the opportunity for rehabilitation and not burdening our criminal justice system with low-level offenders, even though that may be a relative term in this context. We definitely are concerned about criminal justice, and that's what brings us to this area.
So how do you keep all that in mind when you're thinking about legislation on a topic like this and deciding the different facets of it? What are you trying to steer away from or hone in on?
Well, in this area in particular, we're fighting stereotypes that cause people to not really think rationally or make numbers-based policies, but simply emotional laws, and in many cases, overkill. So we had a situation like this a few years ago where we opposed the residency restrictions as a form of banishment, which we consider to be a cruel and unusual punishment. And a very close case decided it was not quite banishment, but it was being applied across the board to all levels of offenders, sexual offenders, and was causing a lot of problems. We have the same problem with registration when it's made especially for a lifetime because it doesn't recognize that individuals change. It is a serious handicap going through life. It interferes with employment, and in many ways, punishments that go on for too long or are too severe simply interfere with rehabilitation or put offenders in situations that are less healthy and maybe even exacerbate the possibility that they will reoffend.
So in 2005, the Iowa General Assembly passed a bill extending prison sentences and strengthening supervision of sex offenders through methods such as electronic monitoring upon their release from prison. How has that changed things to make these restrictions more powerful or to increase restrictions?
Well, it used to be that if you had committed a sexual offense and were required to register on in many cases that you were allowed to stay clean for 10 years and you'd be off the registry and then able to gain employment, able to gain housing, do a lot of things that people on the registry have a very difficult time accomplishing. The federal pressure under federal laws to change that, in many cases to lifetime registration, has interfered with that. It's important to realize that as time goes on, people become less likely to reoffend. I think in terms of sex offenders who reoffend out of prison, I think the figure is something like 40% of those reoffenses occur within the first year, and over time they tail off. But
So is there such a thing as, I mean, is the plan to make this so these people can go back into society and they won't, you know, they're, how does that all balance
Here's
out?
Here's the deal. They're back in society already. And we need to deal with them rationally. We need to make it possible for them to overcome the things that led to their abuse in the first place. And part of that might have been low self-image. I mean, we know that's a factor in terms of incest cases. You know, we need to recognize that in the case of Romeo and Juliet offenses, those really aren't the result of necessarily unhealthy sexual appetite. Relatively speaking, that's more of an age-appropriate relationship than you have, say, with a pedophile, where you have an older adult being involved with very young children. That is something that we need to treat very differently than the statutory rape cases.
And Michael Byers, in your case, the implications of the restrictions and having to meet deadlines for filing for jobs that you hold have made it set you back a bit, I guess it would be fair to say. Would you care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, it has set me back. It is very difficult for me to get jobs. I actually tried to apply for McDonald's, and because I was on the sex offender registry, I could not even get a job at McDonald's. So there's several factors, and I'd like to kind of go back to the conversation that we were just on. There's several factors that apply to this bill and why we're trying to enact this bill. We're starting to realize, due to research, the Iowa Sex Offender Research Council has done studies for the past 5 years on all of the sex offenders in the state of Iowa. And they're realizing that a major contribution to sex offender policy change in Iowa has been the inclusion of the sex offender special sentences. The special sentence requires sex offenders to complete their original sentence with either an additional 10-year or lifetime parole sentence. The incorporation of this policy has already begun to increase prison populations and strain the resources of agencies having the responsibility to monitor those under supervision. The numbers are very high. In 2006, we had zero offenders on special sentences for our parole caseloads. Now, in 2013, we have 330 lifetime parole supervision sex cases and 912 10-year supervision sex cases. So it's causing a very big strain on correctional facilities, parole officers. And research shows that having someone who is not a threat to society on lifetime parole actually increases their risk to reoffend and takes resources away from other offenders who need it. A parole officer only has a certain amount of hours in a day to supervise and monitor so many people. So what this bill would do is it would remove people who are not a threat to Iowa citizens and allow parole officers to dedicate their limited resources to the people who are actively seeking to harm children. Now, when we look at the numbers, if we were to remove these Romeo and Juliet cases from parole and from the sex offender registry, my estimation is that about 350 offenders out of the 5,000 offenders in the state of Iowa would apply. At $17.91 per day, 365 days per year, that's around $7,000 per offender. The total cost for minimum supervision is $3 million. So by eliminating these low-risk offenders who are not a threat to society, it would allow us to implement educational reforms such as our health programs in high schools to educate our children on what healthy relationships are, how to remove themselves from unhealthy relationships, and teaching our men who are in high school on what the sex offender laws are in the state of Iowa. And outside of that, it would also allow us, if that money was not converted to education, it would allow us to, on average, a police officer's average income of the state of Iowa is $20,000. It would allow us to hire 154 more patrol officers to investigate these cases and prevent them from happening.
River to River listeners, what's your take on this bill? Do you have some thoughts to weigh in here? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. We're on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio, or tweet us at IPR Talk. We got a tweet from Amy saying, "I have a good friend who was convicted as an adult for something he did at 13. I'm sure lifetime parole can be lifted in some cases." Randall, I want to ask you about the ACLU opposed the 2,000 feet residency rule, giving more freedom to sex offenders when it comes to where they live. Has the change in the 2,000 feet rule had a mostly positive or negative effect since enacted?
The fact of the rule had a negative impact, I think, overall. Originally, as it was being debated, we opposed it, and then the year after, many other groups from the law enforcement area came in and when they saw how this actually worked, concluded it was a big waste of resources. And where a person sleeps really isn't indicative of sex abuse crimes in terms of prevention. It's we know that sex abuse is not caused by sleeping. It's caused by access. The law was intended to stop pedophiles who, I don't know, we have someone here who can comment on the statistics, but probably a very low percentage are stranger danger cases, maybe only 3% or so. Most sex offenders have a different pattern. They're accessing children they have access to in situations they're very familiar with, and in the end, we can't police all those family situations.
Nicole Merrill, with the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault, you care to weigh in here a little bit?
Yeah, what Randall said is definitely accurate. Most cases are family members, close family friends, and it is about access. And so the registry, you know, there are some good things about it, but we would agree that there are also some things that don't really address the deeper issues with having access and things like that. We actually supported some of the changes several years ago that ended those wide sweeping restrictions and more narrowly tailored it to certain groups of people because there are certain groups of sex offenders that the restrictions really shouldn't apply to at all. And we would definitely agree with that. And it certainly is not perfect and doesn't address a lot of the issues. We would like to see a lot more time, energy, and resources put into prevention education, for example.
So would you compare that ruling on the 2,000 feet to this bill in some way, or are these?
In some ways, our feelings behind it are very similar. Right now, we are neutral on this bill, but there's actually some sections of it that we think are a good thing. Well, the problem when you're too strict on these types of cases is when you're going into the prosecution phase and you're looking at plea bargains and deals, people aren't willing to make these deals where they're going to have to be on the special sentence. And so I think that this may help victims in some ways, because if offenders have a chance to apply to become removed from the special sentence at some point, they may be willing to take deals that actually are for sex offenses. What we see a lot is that deals will start out with charges for sexual assaults, but then it's pled down to a regular type assault to avoid being on the registry. And that's really not helping anyone.
Okay. And it also got very bipartisan support from the Senate. We'll talk about the likelihood of Governor Branstad signing it coming up in a little bit. Thanks to my guests today, and we'll say goodbye to Karen Hamilton at this point. Karen, thanks for being on the show today. We'll continue this conversation. More from my guests. I'm Clay Masters. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. We're discussing a bill that would allow sex offenders to have lifetime parole sentences lifted under specific circumstances. It passed both the House and the Senate. My guests are Michael Byers, back from the first half, a sex offender and former lobbyist for the bill. He's in our Iowa City studios. Randall Wilson, legal director at the Iowa American Civil Liberties Union, and Nicole Merrill, a staff attorney at the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault. As I mentioned in the first half, we reached out to lawmakers, both Republicans and Democrats, and they either declined or were unavailable to come on the show, which brings up a point. The sex offender registry is a bit of an uncomfortable topic to discuss, and it may not be very politically savvy to speak out publicly about a bill that, on its face, gives more freedom to sex offenders. What does this tell us about the stigma or perception of the people on the registry? Anybody can take a crack at that.
Well, I think Michael has lived it, so it'd be good if he could weigh in.
Yeah, Michael, what's your take on that?
The stigma of what it's, how it's changed my life. It's caused several downfalls in my life. My family has been greatly involved in the community. My grandfather was president of Davenport North Little League for 10 years. He actually resigned from his job due to myself being on the registry. You have a lot of people looking at you like you're a child molester, a pedophile. It's very hard to acquire friends because nobody wants to be friends with someone who is a pedophile, and that's the stigma that the sex offender registry portrays to the community. Since the registry has been established, we've seen no decrease in sex crimes in the state of Iowa whatsoever. I will speak up on behalf of evidence and research that has been done. I'm a citizen and I'm not getting a vote to be elected into office, so I don't see how it could affect me. The sex offender registry, what it does is it just it has offenders register certain information with the sheriff's office, such as telephone numbers, email addresses, vehicles, and where they live. I believe that that is taking away from the education that society could be getting, because research shows that most sex cases, up to 75% of sex cases that happen in the state of Iowa, happen inside of the home by a family member or a friend of the family. And also the registry is filling up our prisons. I believe it's creating more fear than education. People look at the registry and they see a bunch of dots around their house and they think, oh my gosh, I have all of these child molesters around me. Now my kids can't go out in the yard. They can't play. That's not true. Actually, I have the numbers for the sex offender registry violations for fiscal year 2012. There were a total of 255 registry violations, and 66 of them were sent back to prison due to their violations. Now, the types of violations are residency restrictions, registry restrictions, which are technical violations, not updating your telephone number, not updating your vehicle information and email address. And then the other category of a violation is area/activity. And fiscal year 2012, only two people fell into the area/activity, which would be someone loitering in a park or doing something that they're not supposed to be doing, acting like a predator, loitering around a school. So only two out of the 66 people were doing something like that. The other 64 were due to residency violations and technical violations, which is it's filling up our prisons, and it's adding to the parole caseloads that we have. Research shows that by 2020, 50% of all of our parole caseloads are going to be lifetime special sentences. And just on these 255 registry violations in fiscal year 2012, the prison terms that those people had to serve for those violations, the economic impact that it had on Iowa for the last 2 years was $84 million.
And Michael, you talked about restrictions and filing with the sheriff's office. And in your case, you lost your job both at your day job and as a lobbyist position as well. Can you talk a little bit about having to keep up with filing changes in your life and the implications of not doing them?
Yeah. The sex offender registry requires me to go into my local sheriff's office four times a year. to either update my information or to make sure that all of my information is on the registry. A failure to register for a first offense is an aggravated misdemeanor, which is up to 2 years in prison. That's what I was charged with recently. The sex offender registry requires you to register all of the jobs that you have. The sheriff that arrested me stated that being a lobbyist on a personal bill was a job, and that I was required to register that with the sex offender registry. So due to this technical violation, I am subject now to an additional 2 years in prison for something that has already been settled. Nobody else is against, and my lawyer cannot figure out why I was even charged with the failure to register.
And the reason that you didn't register was because you weren't being paid for the lobbyist position, is that right?
Yeah, I wasn't volunteering or being paid, and I never stated in any of the subcommittees or committees that I was representing anyone other than myself.
River to River listeners, what's your take on this bill? Do you know a sex offender? Should sex offenders' parole sentencing be lifted in certain circumstances? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. We're on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio, or tweet us at IPR Talk. And we do have somebody on the line, a couple people. We're going to get to Elizabeth first in Cedar Rapids. Elizabeth, what are your thoughts on this bill?
Well, I am kind of in mixed emotions. I think I somewhat understand both sides of the coin, from having starting being incested when I was 4 years old by a great uncle, and later by a stepbrother when I was 10. And that same stepbrother also molested my 3-year-old sister. But do I think some of it's kind of extreme? Yes, I know. I have to say, I don't know all what goes into it, but I did find out a man I was living next door to had been caught in a compromising situation with his own teenage daughter. And for a long time, I could not even bring myself to go outside in my yard, like in my swimsuit. To look at the man just made me sick to my stomach. He had mentioned to me once that for something he did, he no longer could vote. And I thought, what the heck would that be? And somebody told me, if you are a sex offender, that your right to vote is taken away. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so then I tootled down to the police station to see if he was on a registrar, because there was a woman with a daycare across the street, and I live in a neighborhood that's just plastered full of children, and he wasn't. So I was a little confused.
Okay, so a very personal experience tied to this, but you're a bit on the fence because you can see both sides to it.
Sort of. Well, one thing that kind of got me, I saw that movie Horrible Bosses. I don't know if, did you guys see that?
I did not. I don't know if anybody
else. Well, there's a young man in there who gets caught urinating in a park and gets put on a sexual registrar list. Well, okay, I just thought that was just for giggles. I told somebody, how preposterous is that? And they said, well, no, it's true. If you get caught urinating in public, you are put – is that true?
I'm not sure what the current state law is on that, or
– That would be
– something I would, Michael?
Yeah, that would be indecent exposure. Indecent exposure is an aggravated misdemeanor and is punishable of up to 2 years, basically by pulling your genitalia out in public, you're offending someone who is not likely wanting to see your private parts.
So, Elizabeth, are there certain questions or thoughts that you think are important to further this conversation?
Well, I have to say, I did meet, okay, I dated a man who at first I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know if I could do this. He had told me what I told him about my past. He had wondered if he had ruined a whole bunch of adult women's lives. And I said, why, what did you do? And he said, well, he said, I have always been interested in sex. And I thought, oh, I don't even want to know. But later on, I did want to know. I said, so what did you mean by that? He was sexually active at 5 years old. He was telling me he was actually engaging in intercourse at 5 years old. I thought I was going to vomit. And then he got caught molesting. He was a lawn care boy, like 13 years old, and got caught molesting somebody's four-year-old, the man that he mowed yards for. And I said, you know what, Tom, if that would have been this day and age, you know what would have happened to you? Now, this man had a history of horrendous sexual abuse himself. But the only thing that why I still continued to date him was that he was going through therapy. He liked children, and he was kind of the neighborhood fix-it guy for, like, fixing bicycles. He said, I always do everything front and center now. It's totally out in the open where everybody can see me. Now, I don't know how many parents, well, because he wasn't on a registrar list, but he was watching out for his own behavior. And he had told me he had a little girl who was very overweight, who was shunned and made fun of, who always wanted to come around and hang around. I said, Tom, you're not letting her come in your garage, are you? And he said, no. He said, I realize she is coming over here with a bicycle that doesn't need to be fixed because she is so hungry for attention.
Okay, great. Thank you, Elizabeth. I appreciate your input. We'll go now to Karen, who's on the line. Karen, what are your thoughts here? Karen? Apparently Karen is not with us. We'll go to Mary, who's on the line. And from what I understand, Mary, you heard our call for lawmakers to call in. Is this Mary Wolf, right, from the Clinton? Is that correct?
Right. I represent District 98, which is half of Clinton County.
Well, thanks for hearing us say that no lawmakers called in or said that they could be here and calling in. Tell me a little bit about the bill and what the reaction was like in the House.
Well, actually, the reason I called is because to clear up a few things. I think, first of all, you've mentioned a couple of times that this failed through the Senate and the House. It did pass the Senate, came over, passed the House Public Safety Committee, but it hasn't been debated and voted on in the full House yet.
Okay.
So unless
okay.
that happens, it's not going to make it down to the governor's desk to become a law. So that's kind of important. Second of all, pulling out your genitals in public isn't a sex offense unless the state can prove that you did it for sexual gratification. So even though I know there's this general belief that urinating in public, will get you charged and convicted of a sex offense, it's just not true. I mean, there is that requirement that it be done for sexual gratification. Most people who are urinating in public are doing it because they need to urinate and there aren't any bathrooms nearby. And last, being convicted of a sex offense does not in and of itself trigger a loss of voting rights. If it's a felony, which many sex offenses are, you lose your voting rights just like anyone who's convicted of a felony loses their voting rights. But if you're convicted of a misdemeanor level sex offense, you can still vote.
So
those
what do you
are
think
the three things that I just wanted
Thank
to make
you.
Sure everybody was clear on. Sure.
So what do you think the likelihood is that it will make it before the House for a full debate?
That's just totally up to the House majority party leadership. I'm in the minority. We don't have any control over what does or doesn't run. So that's one of those things that someone in the Republican leadership in the House would have to answer.
Okay, Mary, thanks so much for calling in with your comments.
Sure.
And I want to turn now to Nicole Merrill. Talk a little bit about the opposition that your organization originally had with the bill and why things changed.
Initially, the bill was a Senate study bill, and it would change sex offenses in the fourth degree. We were opposed to that because one of the changes that it would make was kind of widening that age gap. We are very much of the opinion that a 13-year-old cannot consent to sexual activity. There are a lot of things that we don't allow 13-year-olds to do that we allow other teenagers to do, drive a car, work, things like that. And we're of the opinion that, you know, children under 14 just don't have the maturity, knowledge, life experience, what have you, to make those very serious decisions whether or not to engage in sexual activity. And so it would be, you know, it would have, the way we were reading the bill, widening that age gap and possibly making it so that a relationship between a 13-year-old and 18-year-old would not require the registry requirement. And there were a lot of other reasons that we weren't in favor of that as well. With Senate File 385, it was drastically changed to more address this issue of allowing people who maybe shouldn't be on the registry anymore to be removed. There are a lot of safeguards put in place. There are risk assessments done. They're required to go through all the treatment. I think Michael pretty well covered a lot of the requirements here. And so, you know, we're about finding the balance between keeping the public safe and, again, not being overly restricted on sex offenders to the detriment of victims.
Okay. It looked like we had Pete. Is Pete still on the line? It looks like Pete from Des Moines is not. So, Michael, talk a little bit about how you move forward here since you're no longer employed as a lobbyist. What's next for you? I mean, is there anything that you can do to continue your cause?
Yeah, well, I would like to add that I am not here to advocate sex offenders. I am not here to try to defend child molesters. In my certain circumstance, she was a month and a half away from 14. She stated to me and my friend introduced me to her. She stated to both of us that she was 16. And I had no reason to believe that she was not. What I'm going to do from here is I'm going to continue to study how these laws are affecting the citizens of Iowa. I'm going to continue to try to be able to raise my child. And I believe this summer I'm going to be sitting down with some representatives and senators, and I'm going to try to talk to them about infiltrating some educational programs that can educate the citizens of Iowa and educate teenagers who are in high school, especially seniors who can fall under this, teaching them that they need to be checking IDs, that they should not believe. Even if a girl looks like she's 25, that does not mean that she's 25. Even though a girl looks like she's 16, it does not mean she's 16. That was the whole fault that I had, was I did not check her ID. Had I known that she was 13 years old, I would have never pursued their relationship.
Pete from Des Moines is back on the line. I want to bring Pete in before we have to wrap up. Pete, what are your thoughts in this conversation?
Yeah, I think something that is really disconcerting is, as this debate has gone on, especially in the media, you've seen even phrases like a Romeo-Juliet romance. This is different than typical sex offenses and registrations. And I think that even that language is coarsening your idea, in that there is a huge difference between the mental capacity of a 13-year-old and an 18-year-old. As your guest here stated, that a 13-year-old's mental state is not that of an adult, and I'm afraid that when we choose to state this is a consensual relationship, when in fact it can't be, we're hardening ourselves to a thing that can be of real danger to a young kid.
And Randall Wilson, thanks, Pete, for that. Quickly, with
I
to wrap
say
up,
that neither is the mental capacity or maturity of an 18-year-old the same as someone who's 25. Our own U.S. Supreme Court just outlawed life sentences for parole as an automatic sentence for juveniles who commit murder, based on that very recognition from science that it takes boys a long time to gain the maturity that we actually expect of them. And so it doesn't make it makes sense to consider whether or not, as they age, whether or not they've gained enough maturity to no longer be on the registry.
And that's where we'll have to end the conversation today. Thanks so much to my guests, Michael Byers, a sex offender and former lobbyist for the bill. Thanks, Michael. Randall Wilson with the legal director at the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, and Nicole Merrill, a staff attorney at the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Jason Burns. Podcasting and on-demand audio for River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us at any time, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.